Roxo Media House.
A Signal 51 is police code for an investigation. A law enforcement proceeding that is a systemic and thorough attempt to learn the facts about a possible crime that is complex and whose facts and circumstances are generally hidden, at least initially, behind obstacles that can be coincidental and or man-made. Investigations methods are formal. I'm John Henry, a journalist. My partner is Jake White, a retired Fort Worth police sergeant. And together, we examine the difficult cases of law enforcement, both in Fort Worth and around the region. This is Signal 51. The show is designed specifically for a more mature audience. Some of the content is graphic and is not intended for younger audiences.
From the Roxo Media House studios in Fort Worth, this is the Signal 51 Chronicles. I'm John Henry with co-host Jake White, retired sergeant of the Fort Worth Police Department. This is Episode 7, Part 2 of Fort Worth, Outlaw Country. On August 21st, 1958, Bobby Ray Foote was shot dead in his car as he traveled northbound in Polytechnic Heights. A man in a car traveling in the other direction forced Foote to stop. That man got out of the car and began shooting into Foote's vehicle. Foote was struck twice, in the stomach and in the back. A known underworld figure, police detectives immediately zeroed in on suspects. A Tarrant County grand jury brought indictments against Garrett Milton Ramsey, Donald Kenneth Gant, and Larry Wade Gasulis.
Almost 2 weeks after the grand jury issued indictments for Ramsey, Gant, and Gasulis, Johnny Green was in custody in Fort Worth for driving a stolen car. September 23, 1958, Green was located in a vacant duplex in South Fort Worth. Green admitted to possessing the stolen car, and when detectives searched the stolen car, they found a torn-up military base pass with the name Beatrice Hazewitz, or Bernice Hazewitz. Records from that day use both names, so it's difficult to discern which is correct. Green told investigators the car belonged to a lady known as Beatrice Tolbert. Green further stated to detectives that Tolbert, quote, ditched him at a bar for a sailor. I can only imagine the gut feeling of the dapper detective Grady Hare led him to follow up with investigators in San Jose, California. The following day, investigators from San Jose PD flew to Fort Worth to interview Green. Why detectives would fly over 1,000 miles to interview a suspect about a stolen car is where the story takes a turn.
On September 20th, 1958, a month after the Foote shooting, the body of Beatrice Hazewitz was found in an industrial area 200 yards from the San Jose police station. Beatrice was discovered with the sleeve of a sweater tied around her neck. Evidence also indicated that Beatrice, married to a sailor and the mother of two sons, had been sexually assaulted. Next to Beatrice's body was a coat with a handwritten phone number and a matchbook. The handwritten phone number was traced back to a relative of Green's who lived in California. When Green was placed under arrest for the murder of Beatrice, he told detectives he was going to surrender because all they had on him was a stolen car, and quote, I wouldn't be stupid enough to leave my coat at the scene of a murder. There is some irony about the coat. This was not the first time Green was caught because of a discarded coat. 2 years before, Green became a suspect in a burglary after detectives found his coat at the scene of the crime. In this case, though, Green was able to prove he was out of town. After Green's arrest, he agreed to an extradition hearing and was flown back to San Jose. After landing in San Francisco, investigators drove Green to San Jose. On the drive from San Francisco to San Jose, Green promptly blurted out, quote, hell, I might as well get it over with, end quote, and he confessed to the murder of Beatrice. All right, Jake, take us through this tragic tale of humanity.
Green told San Jose detectives he killed Bernice in the mountains near Oakland, California. Green, as described in press reports, as a, quote, husky, tattooed hoodlum, choked Bernice with his bare hands, and then threw her into the back seat of the car. After choking her with his hands, he tied the sleeve of the sweater around her neck. After killing Bernice, Johnny Green drove with the deceased body out of the mountains. When he entered San Jose, looking for a place to discard her body, someone rear-ended him while he was stopped at a red light. Green told detectives, quote, "I realized I couldn't wait for a traffic investigation with that body in the back seat."
That's never a good thing.
No, that's not. So Green then fled the scene of the accident and found a desolate area, or what he thought was a desolate area, in San Jose. A desolate area that was only 200 yards from the San Jose PD station. When Green pulled the body from the car, and unbeknownst to him, his coat was under Bernice's body. His coat eventually fell on the ground as he drug the body to a mound of dirt. After discarding the body, Green drove to Compton, California, where he slept for a few hours, and then made the 1,500-plus mile journey back to Fort Worth in the stolen car. In addition to telling detectives about the murder of Bernice, Green also provided detectives with a written confession that went into further detail how he killed her.
So Johnny Green was the passenger of Bobby Ray Foote when Foote was murdered. And we made note in episode 6 that he did not wait around for police for their investigation of that incident. He also was nowhere to be found during the grand jury indictment. We kind of know why. Why was he in California?
As it turned out, Green was now involved in 3 murders. As we mentioned earlier, he was the passenger in Foote's vehicle when he was killed. He confessed to killing Hazewitz, but he had also been charged with the murder of Jesse Fane Williams at a bar near Riverside Drive in Fort Worth. Green fled to California not because of the suspicion he murdered Williams, but because he told police that Ramsey, Gant, and Gusselus were responsible for the murder of Foote.
So in essence, he was afraid that Foote's fate would soon be his. And he ended up in California, escaping that fear. And while there, he has admitted now that he raped and killed a woman in the mountains of Oakland, California.
He did. But because of the quick work by detectives in Fort Worth and San Jose, he was apprehended quickly and ultimately given a life sentence in California for the murder of Bernice Hazewitz.
The investigation involving the murder of Foote continued. In early June 1959, a continuance was granted because authorities were having a difficult time tracking down a witness to serve him a subpoena. The defense alleged that that other man, Jim Miley, was present at the time of the shooting, and furthermore hinted that he was in Ramsey's car. Said Assistant District Attorney Elwood Winters, "They've had everybody in that car but President Eisenhower." In January 1960, Winters and defense attorneys Dave Miller and Ronald Altman flew to San Quentin to depose the, quote, hoodlum, unquote, Johnny Green about his role in the murder of Foote.
Garrett Ramsey seemed to be a counterpart in terms of gang leadership from Johnny Ray Foote. Ramsey led one criminal enterprise and Foote led another, and they clashed. In April 1960, Ramsey's trial for the death of Foote ended in a mistrial. Gant was convicted and sentenced to 99 years. Gusselus's charges were dismissed because of his physical condition after an attempt on his life on New Year's Eve. This was not Ramsey's last run-in with the law involving a murder, though. Later in 1960, Ramsey, who police were now calling, quote, the kingpin of Fort Worth prostitution, was facing murder charges for the death of another described police character, Royce L. Hurd. On June 18th, 1960, the deceased body of Royce Hurd was found in a ditch on a then rural road near Kennedale, Texas. On June 18th, 1960, at approximately 2:30 a.m., at 3700 Sandgate Street in Fort Worth, Heard knocked on the front door of a home reportedly rented by Paul English.
Okay, now hold on one second there, Jake. A home rented by Paul English. Paul English sounds like a very familiar name to me, and also associated with outlaw country.
Fort Worth outlaw country. And if you're referring to the Paul English, who was the drummer for Willie Nelson and Delbert McClinton,
that's the one.
You'd be correct.
I'll be darned.
What happened at the home of Willie Nelson's drummer is another example of how the underworld always finds themselves in these precarious situations. Heard knocks on the door at 2:30 a.m., but instead of English answering the door, police hoodlum Garrett Ramsey answers. When Ramsey opened the door, Heard rushed in, armed with a pistol, and ordered Ramsey to sit down. Soon after Heard rushed inside, a second unknown assailant kicked in the back door. Heard went to the kitchen and shots rang out. During the commotion, Ramsey fled out the front door. Ramsey told police he, quote, dodged bullets from other would-be assassins hiding behind a car across the street. Ramsey returned to the house a short time later and saw Heard on the kitchen floor with a gunshot wound. Heard, still alive, indicated he did not want to go to the hospital. Ramsey told investigators he wrapped the wounded Heard in a blanket and put him in the trunk of a borrowed car, a Cadillac specifically. Next, Ramsey called Meissner Funeral Home and reported he found an accident victim on the side of the road. Ramsey then drove Heard to a desolate road near Kennedale, where he dumped Heard's body. Ramsey returned to English's home and washed the car. In addition to washing the car, Ramsey also said he woke up two other occupants who were reportedly inside the home during the shooting. A couple more police characters, Bobby Lott and Cynthia Martin. Lott and Martin later told investigators they did not hear any commotion inside the house, but they did help Ramsey clean up the blood in the kitchen.
So the picture I'm getting here on this thing is, the movie with John Travolta and Samuel Jackson in the early 90s. You know I'm talking about Tarantino.
Why are you doing this? It's
anyway, you know the scene.
Yeah, yeah. Now I can't even think of the movie title.
But you know the scene I'm talking about.
Yes.
Is the exact scene I'm thinking of where they call the wolf and he comes to the house. And he's charged with cleaning up this mess that's been made.
That's Lott and Martin.
Yes, that's Lott and Martin, right? They're,
except the difference is they actually slept through a shooting inside the house. A house which still stands today.
Yeah.
And you can see a picture of it on our website. You can see the size
of it. Pulp Fiction.
It's the movie.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead. Keep going.
How we can remember that, I have no idea. So this,
that's a picture I see, though. But anyway, go ahead.
I think that's about right. So this Lott and Martin, like I said, they're no strangers to the law. Lott was released from Leavenworth USP, United States Prison, only 5 days prior, and Martin was on probation for aiding the escape of a prisoner at the Gregg County Jail in Gregg County, Texas. To clear his name, Ramsey asked police to give him a lie detector test and a paraffin test.
Yeah, so, you know, Lott and Martin want nothing to do with this, obviously, considering their recent past. Now, a paraffin test, what is that?
So a paraffin test was the predecessor to a gunshot residue test. A paraffin test was a forensic test to indicate whether a person has recently fired a gun. In the test, the person's hand is coated in hot paraffin wax, which cools and sets, and is then peeled off and tested for the presence of residue from the gun.
How far we've come. I'm assuming we don't do this anymore.
No, now they And it may have advanced even more since my time, but it was simply a wipe, much like a an alcohol pad, basically.
Yeah. So they wipe it on the hand and test it.
Uh-huh.
All right.
So Lott and Martin, they agreed to the lie detector test, but not the paraffin test. They wanted nothing to do with this. Ultimately, Fort Worth PD charges Ramsey and Lott with the murder of Hurd. However, I think there was some hesitation on the side of the police because one detective told reporters, quote, and referring to Ramsey, quote, he's coming too clean to be lying. Ramsey, we know he's an elusive criminal. He's a big fish for Fort Worth PD. To help Fort Worth PD reel in this big fish, they call again the Texas Rangers. Police were not taking any shortcuts trying to solve this case. They sent everything, and everything is in quotes, to Dallas for testing. Everything included the windshield of Ramsey's borrowed Cadillac and other ballistic evidence items. So in a strange twist, Ramsey, the same guy who assaulted a police officer only several years prior, wanted the police to now thoroughly investigate the murder of Hurd. Ramsey, while laughing and with a swagger, said, quote, I don't know who those guys were. It looks like they set a trap for me. I want the works to clear myself. I can't afford another charge. The works is what Ramsey got, and the works ultimately led him to being charged in the murder of Hurd. Keep in mind, Royce Hurd was also no stranger to the police. He was arrested 11 times in 1959 and already three times in 1960 just prior to his death.
So it's a tangled web we have here. I find it interesting that the one detective said about he's coming too clean to be lying. These guys are so well known to police and with each other, really, that they actually have a good sense of when they're lying and when they're not lying.
Yeah.
Is that something you yourself have experienced?
Interesting that you brought that up. Yes, I think looking at it from a practical perspective, when you work the same area for years and you talk to the same people for years, as an example, let's say you pull up to a store known to sell dope or a store known for criminal activity, and it's the same cast of characters in the parking lot day in and day out. Sometimes when you pull up and get out of the car, they stick around and talk. Other times you pull up to the store,
They take off.
So, yeah, I think it's kind of similar to that.
All right. So Garrett Ramsey wants this thoroughly investigated to clear his name in this case. A name that's already quite filthy. What happens with the murder charges?
Ramsey's elusive. The murder charge he and Lott faced were ultimately dismissed because they reportedly passed the polygraph exams. In true Ramsey style, he couldn't keep himself out of trouble for long, though.
That is true Garrett Ramsey style. It's hard to tell whether trouble follows him or he follows trouble. But he always steps in a big wad of dog dung eventually. And he does, of course. How long does it take before he finds himself in trouble again?
7 months.
7 months.
Yeah. In late January 1960.
Which probably could have been 7 hours in reality, but 7 months. All right.
It probably was, yeah. He didn't get caught for another 7 months doing something. So late January 1961, Ramsey traveled to the small town of Hereford. That's between Amarillo and Lubbock.
Know it well.
There, Ramsey broke into a grocery store and stole over $9,000, a combination of checks and cash.
That's a good chunk of change in the early 1960s.
Yep.
How does he wind up there and how does he get caught? I mean, what's he doing out there?
So this Ramsey's elusive. Ramsey commits a lot of crimes. He dodges charges. This time was different. Investigators said Ramsey, quote, did a slick job on opening the safe. But the one area he was not slick was when he dropped his wallet containing his hunting license.
Hunting. I wonder what he was hunting out there. What happened with these? He was charged ultimately, and what happened to him in this case?
So Garrett Ramsey, yes, he was charged. He was arrested in Fort Worth and taken to the Deaf Smith County Jail by Hereford Police Chief Henry Acock. Ultimately, Ramsey was sentenced to 8 years in prison. Ramsey later served time in San Quentin with his buddy Green for a string of coin machine thefts. And after his stint in San Quentin, Ramsey returns home and possibly takes a short break from his criminal activity. According to Bud Kennedy, local journalist, starting in 1989, Ramsey, at the age of 56, returns to his life of crime and committed several armed robberies. Ultimately, he was incarcerated for these armed robberies until 2003, when he was paroled. And in late August 2005, Ramsey committed his last theft when he took over $1,000 of Tarrant County taxpayer money for his burial. Ramsey was buried in a cemetery in southeast Tarrant County.
Ramsey's ramshackle life ended in 2005. The moral of this story? Crime and gangland activity do not pay. Between dodging a rival's bullets or not dodging them, as Bobby Ray Foote's fate played out, or a life behind the walls of the state's big house, as Green's and Ramsey's tales of woe demonstrate. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Signal 51 Chronicles. Until next time, I'm John Henry, and that is Jake White. Goodbye.
Roxo Media House.